hallway. She assumed that Betty and her helpers were still eating dessert in the kitchen and would not know that the dining room was deserted. There was no sound. The walls, the panelling, the pervasive heaviness of nearly new fixtures, the colossal fire dogs, the walk-in fireplaces of bright new stone, referred back through the centuries to a time of lonely castles in mute forests. Her father-in-law's intention, she supposed, was to create an ambience of solidity and family tradition. A man who spent a lifetime devising iron bolts and locks understood the value of privacy. Noise from outside the house was excluded completely, and even homelier indoor sounds were muffled and sometimes even eliminated somehow. Emily sighed, failed to hear herself quite, and sighed again. She was by the telephone, which stood on a semicircular wrought-iron table by the library door, and her hand rested upon the receiver. To speak to P.C. Vokins, she would first have to talk to his wife, a garrulous woman who liked to chat about eggs and related matters, the price of chicken feed, the foxes, the frailty of the modern paper bag. Her husband refused to display the deference one might expect from a policeman. He had a sincere way with a platitude which he made resonate like hard-won wisdom in his tight-buttoned chest. It never rained, but it poured. The devil made work for idle hands. One rotten apple spoiled the barrel. The rumour in the village was that before he joined the force and grew his moustache, he was a trade unionist. There was a sighting of him back in the days of the general strike, carrying pamphlets on a train. Besides, what would she ask of the village constable? By the time he had told her that boys would be boys, and raised a search party of half a dozen local men from their beds, an hour would have passed, and the twins would have come back on their own, scared into their senses by the immensity of the world at night. In fact, it was not the boys who were on her mind, but their mother, her sister, or rather, her incarnation within the wiry frame of Lola. When Emily rose from the dining table to comfort the girl, she was surprised by a feeling of resentment. The more she felt it, the more she fussed over Lola to hide it. The scratch on her face was undeniable, the bruising on her arm really rather shocking, given that it was inflicted by little boys. But an old antagonism afflicted Emily. It was her sister Hermione she was soothing. Hermione, stealer of scenes, little mistress of histrionics, whom she pressed against her breasts. As of old, the more Emily seethed, the more attentive she became. And when poor Bryony found the boy's letter, it was the same antagonism that had made Emily turn on her with unusual sharpness. How unfair. But the prospect of her daughter, of any girl younger than herself, opening the envelope and raising the tension by doing it just a little too slowly, and then reading aloud to the company, breaking the news and making herself the centre of the drama, called up old memories and ungenerous thoughts. Hermione had lisped and pranced and pirouetted through their childhoods, showing off at every available moment with no thought. So her scowling, silent older sister believed, for how ludicrous and desperate she appeared. There were always adults available to encourage this relentless preening. And when famously the 11-year-old Emily had shocked a roomful of visitors by running into a French window and cutting her hand so badly that a spray of blood had made a scarlet bouquet on the white muslin dress of a nearby child, it was the 9-year-old Hermione who took centre stage with a screaming attack. While Emily lay in obscurity on the floor in the shadow of a sofa, with a medical uncle applying an expert tourniquet, a dozen relatives worked to calm her sister. And now she was in Paris, frolicking with a man who worked in the wireless, while Emily cared for her children. "Plus ça change," P.C. Vokins might have said. And Lola, like her mother, would not be held back. As soon as the letter was read, she upstaged her runaway brothers with her own dramatic exit. "Mummy will kill me indeed." But it was Mummy whose spirit she was keeping alive. When the twins came back, it was a certain bet that Lola would still have to be found. Bound by an iron principle of self-love, she would stay out longer in the darkness, wrapping herself in some fabricated misfortune, so that the general relief when she appeared would be all the more intense and all the attention would be hers. That afternoon, without stirring from her daybed, Emily had guessed that Lola was undermining Bryony's play, a suspicion confirmed by the diagonally ripped poster on the easel. And just as she predicted, Bryony had been outside somewhere, sulking and impossible to find. How like Hermione Lola was, to remain guiltless while others destroyed themselves at her prompting. Emily stood irresolutely in the hall, wishing to be in no particular room, straining for the voices of the searchers outside, and, if she was honest with herself, relieved she could hear nothing. It was a drama about nothing, the missing boys. It was Hermione's life imposed upon her own. There was no reason to worry about the twins. They were unlikely to go near the river. Surely they would tire and come home. She was ringed by thick walls of silence which hissed in her ears, rising and falling in volume to some pattern of its own. She took her hand from the phone and massaged her forehead. No trace of the beast migraine, and thank God for that, and went toward the drawing room. Another reason not to dial PC Vokins was that soon Jack would phone with his apologies. The call would be placed through the ministry operator. Then she would hear the young assistant with the nasal whinnying voice, and finally her husband's from behind his desk, resonating in the enormous room with the coffered ceiling. That he worked late, she did not doubt. But she knew he did not sleep at his club, and he knew that she knew this. But there was nothing to say. Or rather, there was too much. They resembled each other in their dread of conflict, and the regularity of his evening calls, however much she disbelieved them, was a comfort to them both. If this sham was conventional hypocrisy, she had to concede that it had its uses. She had sources of contentment in her life, the house, the park, above all the children, and she intended to preserve them by not challenging Jack. And she did not miss his presence so much as his voice on the phone. Even being lied to constantly, though hardly like love, was sustained attention. He must care about her to fabricate so elaborately and over such a long stretch of time. His deceit was a form of tribute to the importance of their marriage. Wronged child, wronged wife. But she was not as unhappy as she should be. One role had prepared her for the other. She paused in the entrance to the drawing room and observed that the chocolate-smeared cocktail glasses had yet to be cleared away and that the doors into the garden still stood open. Now the faintest stirring of a breeze rustled the display of sedge that stood before the fireplace. Two or three stout-bodied moths circled the lamp that stood upon the harpsichord. When would anyone ever play it again? That night creatures were drawn to lights, where they could be most easily eaten by other creatures, was one of those mysteries that gave her modest pleasure. She preferred not to have it explained away. At a formal dinner once, a professor of some science or other, wanting to make small talk, had pointed out a few insects gyrating above a candelabra. He had told her that it was the visual impression of an even deeper darkness beyond the light that drew them in. Even though they might be eaten, they had to obey the instinct that made them seek out the darkest place, on the far side of the light, and in this case, it was an illusion. It sounded to her like sophistry, or an explanation for its own sake. How could anyone presume to know the world through the eyes of an insect? Not everything had a cause, and pretending otherwise was an interference in the workings of the world that was futile and could even lead to grief. Some things were simply so. She did not wish to know why Jack spent so many consecutive nights in London. Or rather, she did not wish to be told. Nor did she wish to know more about the work that kept him late at the ministry. Months ago, not long after Christmas, she went into the library to wake him from an afternoon sleep and saw a file open upon the desk. It was only the mildest wifely curiosity that prompted her to peep, for she had little interest in civic administration. On one page, she saw a list of headings. Exchange controls, rationing, the mass evacuation of large towns, the conscription of labour. The facing page was handwritten. A series of arithmetical calculations was interspersed by blocks of text. Jack's straight-backed, brown-ink copper plate told her to assume a multiplier of 50. For every 1 ton of explosive dropped, assume 50 casualties. Assume 100,000 tons of bombs dropped in 2 weeks. Result, 5 million casualties. She had not yet woken him, and his soft whistling exhalations blended with winter birdsong that came from somewhere beyond the lawn. Aqueous sunlight rippled over the spines of books, and the smell of warm dust was everywhere. She went to the window and stared out, trying to spot the bird among bare oak branches that stood out black against a broken sky of grey and palest blue. She knew well there had to be such forms of bureaucratic supposition. And yes, there were precautions administrators took to indemnify themselves against all eventualities. But these extravagant numbers were surely a form of self-aggrandizement and reckless to the point of irresponsibility. Jack, the household's protector, its guarantor of tranquillity, was relied on to take the long view. But this was silly. When she woke him, he grunted and leaned forward with a sudden movement to close the files, and then, still seated, pulled her hand to his mouth and kissed it dryly. She decided against closing the French windows and sat down at one end of the Chesterfield. She was not exactly waiting, she felt. No one else she knew had her knack of keeping still, without even a book on her lap, of moving gently through her thoughts as one might explore a new garden. She had learned her patience through years of sidestepping migraine. Fretting, concentrated thought, reading, looking, wanting, all were to be avoided in favour of a slow drift of association, while the minutes accumulated like banked snow and the silence deepened around her. Sitting here now, she felt the night air tickle the hem of her dress against her shin. Her childhood was as tangible as the shot silk. A taste, a sound, a smell, all of these blended into an entity that was surely more than a mood. There was a presence in the room. Her aggrieved, overlooked 10-year-old self, a girl even quieter than Bryony, who used to wonder at the massive emptiness of time and marvel that the 19th century was about to end. How like her, to sit in the room like this, not joining in. This ghost had been summoned not by Lola imitating Hermione, or the inscrutable twins disappearing into the night. It was the slow retraction, the retreat into autonomy, which signalled the approaching end of Bryony's childhood. It was haunting Emily once more. Bryony was her last, and nothing between now and the grave would be as elementally important or pleasurable as the care of a child. She wasn't a fool. She knew it was self-pity, this mellow expansiveness, as she contemplated what looked like her own ruin. Bryony would surely go off to her sister's college, Girton, and she, Emily, would grow stiffer in the limbs and more irrelevant by the day. Age and weariness would return Jack to her, and nothing would be said, or needed to be said. And here was the ghost of her childhood, diffused throughout the room, to remind her of the limited arc of existence. How quickly the story was over. Not massive and empty at all, but headlong, ruthless. Her spirits were not particularly lowered by these commonplace reflections. She floated above them, gazing down neutrally, absently braiding them with other preoccupations. She planned to plant a clump of ceanothus along the approach to the swimming pool. Robbie was wanting to persuade her to erect a pergola and train along it a slow-growing wisteria whose flower and scent he liked. But she and Jack would be long buried before the full effect was achieved. The story would be over. She thought of Robbie at dinner, when there had been something manic and glazed in his look. Might he be smoking the reefers she had read about in a magazine? These cigarettes that drove young men of bohemian inclination across the borders of insanity? She liked him well enough, and was pleased for Grace Turner that he had turned out to be bright. But really, he was a hobby of Jack's, living proof of some levelling principle he had pursued through the years. When he spoke about Robbie, which wasn't often, it was with a touch of self-righteous vindication. Something had been established which Emily took to be a criticism of herself. She had opposed Jack when he proposed paying for the boy's education, which smacked of meddling to her, and unfair on Leon and the girls. She did not consider herself proved wrong simply because Robbie had come away from Cambridge with a first. In fact, it had made things harder for Cecilia with her third, though it was preposterous of her to pretend to be disappointed. Robbie's elevation. "Nothing good will come of it," was the phrase she often used, to which Jack would respond smugly that plenty of good had come already. For all that, Bryony had been thoroughly improper at dinner to speak that way to Robbie. If she had resentments of her own, Emily sympathised. It was to be expected. But to express them was undignified. Thinking of the dinner again, how artfully Mr. Marshall had put everyone at ease. Was he suitable? It was a pity about his looks, with one half of his face looking like an over-furnished bedroom. Perhaps in time it would come to seem rugged, this chin like a wedge of cheese. Or chocolate. If he really were to supply the whole of the British Army with ammo bars, he could become immensely rich. But Cecilia, having learned modern forms of snobbery at Cambridge, considered a man with a degree in chemistry incomplete as a human being. Her very words. She had lolled about for 3 years at Girton with the kind of book she could equally have read at home. Jane Austen, Dickens, Conrad, all in the library downstairs, in complete sets. How had that pursuit, reading the novels that others took as their leisure, let her think she was superior to anyone else? Even a chemist had his uses, and this one had found a way of making chocolate out of sugar, chemicals, brown colouring and vegetable oil, and no cocoa butter. To produce a ton of the stuff, he had explained over his astonishing cocktail, cost next to nothing. He could undercut his competitors and increase his profit margin. Vulgarly put, but what comfort, what untroubled years might flow from these cheap vats? More than 30 minutes passed unnoticed as these scraps, memories, judgments, vague resolutions, questions, uncoiled quietly before her, while she barely shifted her position and did not hear the clock strike the quarter hours. She was aware of the breeze strengthening, pushing one French window closed before dying down once more. She was disturbed later by Betty and her helpers clearing the dining room. Then those sounds also subsided, and again Emily was far out along the branching roads of her reveries, drifting by association, and with the expertise born of 1,000 headaches, avoiding all things sudden or harsh. When at last the phone rang, she rose immediately, without any start of surprise, and went back out into the hall, lifted the receiver, and called out as she always did on a rising note of a question, "Tallis's?" There came the switchboard, the nasal assistant, a pause and the crackle of the long-distance line, then Jack's neutral tone. "Dearest, later than usual. I'm terribly sorry." It was 11:30. But she did not mind, for he would be back at the weekend, and one day he would be home forever, and not an unkind word would be spoken. She said, "It's perfectly all right." "It's the revisions to the statement relating to defence. There's to be a second printing, and then one thing and another. Rearmament, she said soothingly. I'm afraid so. You know everyone's against it. He chuckled. Not in this office. And I am. Well, my dear, I hope to persuade you one day. And I you. The exchange held a trace of affection, and its familiarity was comfort. As usual, he asked for an account of her day. She told him of the great heat, the collapse of Bryony's play, and the arrival of Leon with his friend, of whom she said, "He's in your camp, but he wants more soldiers so that he can sell the government his chocolate bar." I see. Plowshares into tin foil. She described the dinner and Robbie's wild look at the table. Do we really need to be putting him through medical college? We do. It's a bold move, typical of him. I know he'll make a go of it. Then she gave an account of how the dinner ended with the twins' note and the search parties going off into the grounds. Little scallywags. And where were they, after all? I don't know. I'm still waiting to hear. There was silence down the line, broken only by distant, mechanical clicking. When the senior civil servant spoke at last, he had already made his decisions. The rare use of her first name conveyed his seriousness. I'm going to put the telephone down now, Emily, because I'm going to call the police. Is it really necessary? By the time they get here, if you hear any news, you'll let me know straight away. Wait. At a sound, she had turned. Leon was coming through the main door. Close behind him was Cecilia, whose look was one of mute bewilderment. Then came Bryony with an arm round her cousin's shoulders. Lola's face was so white and rigid, like a clay mask, that Emily, unable to read an expression there, instantly knew the worst. Where were the twins? Leon crossed the hall toward her, his hand outstretched for the phone. There was a streak of dirt from his trouser cuffs to the knees. Mud, and in such dry weather. His breathing was heavy from exertion, and a greasy lank of hair swung over his face as he snatched the receiver from her and turned his back. "Is that you, Daddy?" "Yes. Look, I think you better come down." "No, we haven't, and there's worse. No, I can't tell you now. If you can, tonight. We'll have to phone them anyway. Best you do it." She put her hand over her heart and took a couple of paces back to where Cecilia and the girls stood watching. Leon had lowered his voice and was muttering quickly into the cupped receiver. Emily couldn't hear a word and did not want to. She would have preferred to retreat upstairs to her room, but Leon finished the call with an echoing rattle of the Bakelite and turned to her. His eyes were tight and hard, and she wondered if it was anger that she saw. He was trying to take deeper breaths, and he stretched his lips across his teeth in a strange grimace. He said, "We'll go in the drawing room where we can sit down." She caught his meaning precisely. He wouldn't tell her now. He wouldn't have her collapsing on the tiles and cracking her skull. She stared at him, but she did not move. "Come on, Emily," he said. Her son's hand was hot and heavy on her shoulder, and she felt its dampness through the silk. Helplessly, she let herself be guided toward the drawing room, all her terror concentrated on the simple fact that he wanted her seated before he broke his news. Chapter 13. Within the half hour, Bryony would commit her crime. Conscious that she was sharing the night expanse with a maniac, she kept close to the shadowed walls of the house at first, and ducked low beneath the sills whenever she passed in front of a lighted window. She knew he would be heading off down the main drive, because that was the way her sister had gone with Leon. As soon as she thought a safe distance had opened up, Bryony swung out boldly from the house in a wide arc that took her toward the stable block and the swimming pool. It made sense, surely, to see if the twins were there, fooling about with the hoses or floating face down in death, indistinguishable to the last. She thought how she might describe it, the way they bobbed on the illuminated water's gentle swell, and how their hair spread like tendrils and their clothed bodies softly collided and drifted apart. The dry night air slipped between the fabric of her dress and her skin, and she felt smooth and agile in the dark. There was nothing she could not describe. The gentle pad of a maniac's tread moving sinuously along the drive, keeping to the verge to muffle his approach. But her brother was with Cecilia, and that was a burden lifted. She could describe this delicious air too, the grasses giving off their sweet cattle smell, the hard-fired earth which still held the embers of the day's heat and exhaled the mineral odour of clay, and the faint breeze carrying from the lake a flavour of green and silver. She broke into a loping run across the grass and thought she could go on all night, knifing through the silky air, sprung forward by the steely coil of the hard ground under her feet and by the way darkness doubled the impression of speed. She had dreams in which she ran like this, then tilted forward, spread her arms, and yielding to faith, the only difficult part but easy enough in sleep, left the ground by simply stepping off it and swooped low over hedges and gates and roofs, then hurtled upward and hovered exultantly below the cloud base, above the fields, before diving down again. She sensed now how this might be achieved through desire alone. The world she ran through loved her and would give her what she wanted and would let it happen. And then, when it did, she would describe it. Wasn't writing a kind of soaring, an achievable form of flight, of fancy, of the imagination? But there was a maniac treading through the night with a dark, unfulfilled heart. She had frustrated him once already, and she needed to be earthbound to describe him too. She must first protect her sister against him, and then find ways of conjuring him safely on paper. Bryony slowed to a walking pace and thought how he must hate her for interrupting him in the library. And though it horrified her, it was another entry, a moment of coming into being, another first. To be hated by an adult. Children hated generously, capriciously. It hardly mattered. But to be the object of adult hatred was an initiation into a solemn new world. It was promotion. He might have doubled back and be waiting for her with murderous thoughts behind the stable block. But she was trying not to be afraid. She had held his gaze there in the library while her sister had slipped past her, giving no outward acknowledgement of her deliverance. It was not about thanks, she knew that. It was not about rewards. In matters of selfless love, nothing needed to be said, and she would protect her sister, even if Cecilia failed to acknowledge her debt. And Bryony could not be afraid now of Robbie. Better by far to let him become the object of her detestation and disgust. They had provided for all manner of pleasant things for him, the Tallis family. The very home he had grown up in, countless trips to France, and his grammar school uniform and books, and then Cambridge, and in return he had used a terrible word against her sister, and in a fantastic abuse of hospitality used his strength against her too, and sat insolently at their dining table, pretending that nothing was different. The pretense, and how she ached to expose it. Real life, her life now beginning, had sent her a villain in the form of an old family friend with strong, awkward limbs and a rugged, friendly face who used to carry her on his back and swim with her in the river, holding her against the current. That seemed about right. Truth was strange and deceptive. It had to be struggled for against the flow of the everyday. This was exactly what no one would have expected. And of course, villains were not announced with hisses or soliloquies. They did not come cloaked in black with ugly expressions. Across the other side of the house, walking away from her, were Leon and Cecilia. She might be telling him about the assault. If she was, he would have his arm around her shoulders. Together, the Tallis children would see this brute off, see him safely out of their lives. They would have to confront and convert their father and comfort him in his rage and disappointment. That his protégé should turn out to be a maniac. Lola's words stirred the dust of other words around it. Man, mad, axe, attack, accuse, and confirmed the diagnosis. She made her way round the stable block and stopped under the arched entrance beneath the clock tower. She called out the twins' names and heard in reply only the stir and scuff of hooves and the thump of a heavy body pressing against a stall. She was glad she had never fallen for a horse or pony, for she would surely be neglecting it by this stage of her life. She did not approach the animals now, even though they sensed her presence. In their terms, a genius, a god, was loitering on the periphery of their world, and they were straining for her attention. But she turned and continued toward the swimming pool. She wondered whether having final responsibility for someone, even a creature like a horse or a dog, was fundamentally opposed to the wild and inward journey of writing. Protective, worrying, engaging with another's mind as one entered it, taking the dominant role as one guided another's fate, was hardly mental freedom. Perhaps she might become one of those women, pitied or envied, who chose not to have children. She followed the brick path that led round the outside of the stable block. Like the earth, the sandy bricks radiated the day's trapped heat. She felt it on her cheek and down her bare calf as she passed along. She stumbled as she hurried through the darkness of the bamboo tunnel and emerged onto the reassuring geometry of the paving stones.
This ends Disc 5, Atonement, Disc 6.
The underwater lights installed that spring were still a novelty. The upward bluish gleam gave everything around the pool a colourless, moonlit look, like a photograph. A glass jug, two tumblers and a piece of cloth stood on the old tin table. A third tumbler, containing pieces of soft fruit, stood poised at the end of the diving board. There were no bodies in the pool, no giggling from the darkness of the pavilion, no shushing from the shadows of the bamboo thickets. She took a slow turn around the pool, no longer searching, but drawn to the glow and glassy stillness of the water. For all the threat the maniac posed to her sister, it was delightful to be out so late with permission. She did not really think the twins were in danger. Even if they had seen the framed map of the area in the library and were clever enough to read it, and were intending to leave the grounds and walk north all night, they would have to follow the drive into the woods along by the railway line. At this time of year, when the tree canopy was thick over the road, the way was in total blackness. The only other route out was through the kissing gate down toward the river. But here too there would be no light, no way of keeping to the path or ducking the branches that hung low over it, or dodging the nettles that grew thickly on either side. They would not be bold enough to put themselves in danger. They were safe. Cecilia was with Leon, and she, Bryony, was free to wander in the dark and contemplate her extraordinary day. Her childhood had ended, she decided now as she came away from the swimming pool, the moment she tore down her poster. The fairy stories were behind her, and in the space of a few hours she had witnessed mysteries, seen an unspeakable word, interrupted brutal behaviour, and by incurring the hatred of an adult whom everyone had trusted, she had become a participant in the drama of life beyond the nursery. All she had to do now was discover the stories, not just the subjects, but a way of unfolding them that would do justice to her new knowledge. Or did she mean her wiser grasp of her own ignorance. Staring at water for minutes on end had put her in mind of the lake. Perhaps the boys were hiding in the island temple. It was obscure, but not too cut off from the house, a friendly little place, with the consolation of water and not too many shadows. The others might have gone straight across the bridge without looking down there. She decided to keep to her route and reach the lake by circling round the back of the house. 2 minutes later, she was crossing the rose beds and the gravel path in front of the Triton Fountain, scene of another mystery that clearly foretold the later brutalities. As she passed it, she thought she heard a faint shout and thought she saw from the corner of her eye a point of light flash on and off. She stopped and strained to hear over the sound of trickling water. The shout and the light had come from the woods by the river a few hundred yards away. She walked in that direction for half a minute and stopped to listen again. But there was nothing. Nothing but the tumbling dark mass of the woods, just discernible against the greyish blue of the western sky. After waiting a while, she decided to turn back. In order to pick up her path, she was walking directly toward the house, toward the terrace, where a paraffin globe lamp shone among glasses, bottles, and an ice bucket. The drawing-room French windows still stood wide open to the night. She could see right into the room. And by the light of a single lamp, she could see, partially obscured by the hang of a velvet curtain, one end of a sofa, across which there lay, at a peculiar angle, a cylindrical object that seemed to hover. It was only after she had covered another 50 yards that she understood that she was looking at a disembodied human leg. Closer still, and she grasped the perspectives. It was her mother's, of course, and she would be waiting for the twins. She was mostly obscured by the drapes, and one stockinged leg was supported by the knee of the other, which gave it its curious slanting and levitated appearance. Bryony moved to a window on her left as she came right up to the house in order to be clear of Emily's sightline. She was positioned too far behind her mother to see her eyes. She could make out only the dip in her cheekbone of her eye socket. Bryony was certain her eyes would be closed. Her head was tilted back, and her hands lay lightly clasped in her lap. Her right shoulder rose and fell faintly with her breathing. Bryony could not see her mouth, but she knew its downward curve, easily mistaken for the sign, the hieroglyph of reproach. But it was not so, because her mother was endlessly kind and sweet and good. Looking at her, sitting alone late at night, was sad but pleasantly so. Bryony indulged herself by looking through the window in a spirit of farewell. Her mother was 46, dispiritingly old. One day she would die. There would be a funeral in the village, at which Bryony's dignified reticence would hint at the vastness of her sorrow. As her friends came up to murmur their condolences, they would feel awed by the scale of her tragedy. She saw herself standing alone in a great arena, within a towering coliseum, watched not only by all the people she knew, but by all those she would ever know, the whole cast of her life, assembled to love her in her loss. And at the churchyard, in what they called the grandparents' corner, she and Leon and Cecilia would stand in an interminable embrace in the long grass by the new headstone, again watched. It had to be witnessed. It was the pity of these well-wishers that pricked her eyes. She could have gone into her mother then and snuggled close beside her and begun a resume of the day. If she had, she would not have committed her crime. So much would not have happened. Nothing would have happened, and the smoothing hand of time would have made the evening barely memorable, the night the twins ran away. Was it 34, or 5, or 6? But for no particular reason, apart from the vague obligation of the search and the pleasure of being out so late, She came away, and as she did so, her shoulder caught an edge of one of the open French windows, knocking it shut. The sound was sharp, seasoned pine on hardwood, and rang out like a rebuke. To stay, she would have to explain herself. So she slipped away into the darkness, tiptoeing quickly over the slabs of stone and the scented herbs that grew between them. Then she was on the lawn between the rose beds, where it was possible to run soundlessly. She came round the side of the house to the front, onto the gravel she had hobbled across barefoot that afternoon. Here she slowed, as she turned down the driveway toward the bridge. She was back at her starting point and thought she was bound to see the others or hear their calls. But there was no one. The dark shapes of the widely spaced trees across the park made her hesitate. Someone hated her. That had to be remembered. And he was unpredictable and violent. Leon, Cecilia, and Mr. Marshall would be a long way off now. The nearer trees, or at least their trunks, had a human form, or could conceal one. Even a man standing in front of a tree trunk would not be visible to her. For the first time, she was aware of the breeze pouring through the tops of the trees, and this familiar sound unsettled her. Millions of separate and precise agitations bombarded her senses. When the wind picked up briefly and died, the sound moved away from her, travelling out across the darkened park like a living thing. She stopped and wondered whether she had the courage to keep on to the bridge, cross it, and leave it to go down the steep bank to the island temple. Especially when there really was not much at stake, just a hunch of hers that the boys may have wandered down there. Unlike the adults, she had no torch. Nothing was expected of her. She was a child, after all, in their eyes. The twins were not in danger. She remained on the gravel for a minute or two, not quite frightened enough to turn back, nor confident enough to go on. She could return to her mother and keep her company in the drawing room while she waited. She could take a safer route along the driveway and back, before it entered the woods, and still give the impression of a serious search. Then, precisely because the day had proved to her that she was not a child, and that she was now a figure in a richer story, and had to prove herself worthy of it, she forced herself to walk on and cross the bridge. From beneath her, amplified by the stone arch, came the hiss of the breeze disturbing the sedge, and a sudden beating of wings against water, which subsided abruptly. These were everyday sounds magnified by darkness. And darkness was nothing. It was not a substance. It was not a presence. It was no more than an absence of light. The bridge led to nothing more than an artificial island in an artificial lake. It had been there 200 years almost, and its detachment marked it out from the rest of the land, and it belonged to her more than to anyone else. She was the only one who ever came here. To the others, it was no more than a corridor to and from home, a bridge between the bridges, an ornament so familiar as to be invisible. Hardman came with his son twice a year to scythe the grass around the temple. The tramps had passed through. Stray migrating geese sometimes honoured the little grassy shore. Otherwise, it was a lonely kingdom of rabbits, water birds, and water rats. So it should have been a simple matter to pick her way down the bank and go across the grass toward the temple. But again she hesitated and simply looked, without even calling out to the twins. The building's indistinct pallor shimmered in the dark. When she stared at it directly, it dissolved completely. It stood about 100 feet away, and nearer, in the centre of the grassy stretch, there was a shrub she did not remember. Or rather, she remembered it being closer to the shore. The trees were not right either, what she could see of them. The oak was too bulbous, the elm too straggly, and in their strangeness they seemed in league. As she put her hand out to touch the parapet of the bridge, a duck startled her with a high, unpleasant call, almost human in its breathy downward note. It was the steepness of the bank, of course, which held her back, and the idea of descent, and the fact that there was not much point. But she had made her decision. She went down backward, steadying herself on clumps of grass, and at the bottom paused only to wipe her hands on her dress. She walked directly toward the temple, and had gone 7 or 8 steps, and was about to call out the names of the twins, when the bush that lay directly in her path, the one she thought should be closer to the shore, began to break up in front of her, or double itself, or waver, and then fork. It was changing its shape in a complicated way, thinning at the base as a vertical column rose 5 or 6 feet. She would have stopped immediately had she not still been so completely bound to the notion that this was a bush, and that she was witnessing some trick of darkness and perspective. Another second or two, another couple of steps, and she saw that this was not so. Then she stopped. The vertical mass was a figure, a person who was now backing away from her and beginning to fade into the darker background of the trees. The remaining darker patch on the ground was also a person, changing shape again as it sat up and called her name.
Bryony?
She heard the helplessness in Lola's voice. It was the sound she had thought belonged to a duck. And in an instant, Bryony understood completely. She was nauseous with disgust and fear. Now the larger figure reappeared, circling right round the edge of the clearing and heading for the bank down which she had just come. She knew she should attend to Lola, but she could not help watching as he mounted the slope quickly and without effort and disappeared onto the roadway. She heard his footsteps as he strode toward the house. She had no doubt. She could describe him. There was nothing she could not describe. She knelt down beside her cousin.
Lola, are you all right?
Bryony touched her shoulder and was groping for her hand without success. Lola was sitting forward, with her arms crossed around her chest, hugging herself and rocking slightly. The voice was faint and distorted, as though impeded by something like a bubble, some mucus in her throat. She needed to clear her throat. She said vaguely,
I'm sorry. I didn't. I'm sorry.
Bryony whispered,
Who was it?
And before that could be answered, she added, with all the calm she was capable of,
I saw him. I saw him.
Meekly, Lola said,
Yes.
For the second time that evening, Bryony felt a flowering of tenderness for her cousin. Together they faced real terrors. She and her cousin were close. Bryony was on her knees, trying to put her arms round Lola and gather her to her. But the body was bony and unyielding, wrapped tight about itself like a seashell, a winkle. Lola hugged herself and rocked. Bryony said,
It was him, wasn't it?
She felt, against her chest, rather than saw, her cousin nod, slowly, reflectively. Perhaps it was exhaustion. After many seconds, Lola said in the same weak, submissive voice,
Yes, it was him.
Suddenly, Bryony wanted her to say his name, to seal the crime, frame it with the victim's curse, close his fate with the magic of naming.
Lola,
she whispered, and could not deny the strange elation she felt.
Lola, who was it?
The rocking stopped. The island became very still. Without quite shifting her position, Lola seemed to move away, or to move her shoulders, half shrug, half sway, to free herself of Bryony's sympathetic touch. She turned her head away and looked out across the emptiness where the lake was. She may have been about to speak. She may have been about to embark upon a long confession in which she would find her feelings as she spoke them and lead herself out of her numbness towards something that resembled both terror and joy. Turning away may well have been not a distancing, but an act of intimacy, a way of gathering herself to begin to speak her feelings to the only person she thought, so far from home, she could trust herself to talk to. Perhaps she had already drawn breath and parted her lips. But it did not matter, because Bryony was about to cut her off, and the opportunity would be lost. So many seconds had passed. 30, 45, and the younger girl could no longer hold herself back. Everything connected. It was her own discovery. It was her story, the one that was writing itself around her. It was Robbie, wasn't it? The maniac, she wanted to say the word. Lola said nothing and did not move. Bryony said it again, this time without the trace of a question. It was a statement of fact. It was Robbie. Though she had not turned or moved at all, it was clear that something was changing in Lola. A warmth rising from her skin, and a sound of dry swallowing, a heaving convulsion of muscle in her throat that was audible as a series of sinewy clicks. Bryony said it again, simply, Robbie. From far out in the lake came the fat, rounded plop of a fish, jumping, a precise and solitary sound, for the breeze had dropped away completely. Nothing scary in the treetops or among the sedge now. At last, Lola turned slowly to face her. She said, "You saw him." "How could he?" Bryony moaned. "How dare he?" Lola placed her hand on her bare forearm and gripped. Her mild words were widely spaced. "You saw him." Bryony drew nearer to her and covered Lola's hand with her own. "You don't even know yet what happened in the library before dinner, just after we were talking. He was attacking my sister. If I hadn't come in, I don't know what he would have done." However close they were, it was not possible to read expressions. The dark disk of Lola's face showed nothing at all, but Bryony sensed she was only half listening, and this was confirmed when she cut in to repeat, "But you saw him. You actually saw him." "Of course I did, plain as day, it was him." Despite the warmth of the night, Lola was beginning to shiver, and Bryony longed for something she could take off and place round her shoulders. Lola said, "He came up behind me, you see. He knocked me to the ground and then he pushed my head back and his hand was over my eyes. I couldn't actually... I wasn't able..." "Oh, Lola!" Bryony put out her hand to touch her cousin's face and found her cheek. It was dry, but it wouldn't be, she knew it wouldn't be, for long. "Listen to me. I couldn't mistake him. I've known him all my life. I saw him. Because I couldn't say for sure. I mean, I thought it might be him by his voice." "What did he say?" "Nothing. I mean, it was the sound of his voice, breathing, noises. But I couldn't see. I couldn't say for sure." "Well, I can, and I will." And so their respective positions, which were to find public expression in the weeks and months to come, and then be pursued as demons in private for many years afterward, were established in these moments by the lake, with Bryony's certainty rising whenever her cousin appeared to doubt herself. Nothing much was ever required of Lola after that, for she was able to retreat behind an air of wounded confusion, and as treasured patient, recovering victim, lost child, let herself be bathed in the concern and guilt of the adults in her life. How could we have let this happen to a child? Lola could not and did not need to help them. Bryony offered her a chance, and she seized it instinctively. Less than that, she simply let it settle over her. She had little more to do than remain silent behind her cousin's zeal. Lola did not need to lie, to look her supposed attacker in the eye and summon the courage to accuse him, because all that work was done for her, innocently and without guile by the younger girl. Lola was required only to remain silent about the truth, banish it and forget it entirely, and persuade herself not of some contrary tale, but simply of her own uncertainty. She couldn't see, his hand was over her eyes. She was terrified. She couldn't say for sure. Bryony was there to help her at every stage. As far as she was concerned, everything fitted. The terrible present fulfilled the recent past. Events she herself witnessed foretold her cousin's calamity. If only she, Bryony, had been less innocent, less stupid. Now she saw the affair was too consistent, too symmetrical to be anything other than what she said it was. She blamed herself for her childish assumption that Robbie would limit his attentions to Cecilia. What was she thinking of? He was a maniac, after all. Anyone would do. And he was bound to go for the most vulnerable, a spindly girl, stumbling about in the dark, in an unfamiliar place, bravely searching around the island temple for her brothers. Just as Bryony herself had been about to do. That his victim could easily have been her increased Bryony's outrage and fervour. If her poor cousin was not able to command the truth, then she would do it for her. I can, and I will. As early as the week that followed, the glazed surface of conviction was not without its blemishes and hairline cracks. Whenever she was conscious of them, which was not often, she was driven back with a little swooping sensation in her stomach to the understanding that what she knew was not literally or not only based on the visible. It was not simply her eyes that told her the truth. It was too dark for that. Even Lola's face at 18 inches was an empty oval. And this figure was many feet away and turned from her as it moved back around the clearing. But nor was this figure invisible, and its size and manner of moving were familiar to her. Her eyes confirmed the sum of all she knew and had recently experienced. The truth was in the symmetry, which was to say, it was founded in common sense. The truth instructed her eyes. So when she said over and again, "I saw him," she meant it, and was perfectly honest as well as passionate. What she meant was rather more complex than what everyone else so eagerly understood, and her moments of unease came when she felt that she could not express these nuances. She did not even seriously try. There were no opportunities, no time, no permission. Within a couple of days, no, within a matter of hours, a process was moving fast and well beyond her control. Her words summoned awful powers from the familiar and picturesque local town. It was as if these terrifying authorities, these uniformed agents, had been lying in wait behind the facades of pretty buildings for a disaster they knew must come. They knew their own minds. They knew what they wanted and how to proceed. She was asked again and again, and as she repeated herself, the burden of consistency was pressed upon her. What she had said, she must say again. Minor deviations earned her little frowns on wise brows, or a degree of frostiness and withdrawal of sympathy. She became anxious to please, and learned quickly that the minor qualification she might have added would disrupt the process that she herself had set in train. She was like a bride-to-be who begins to feel her sickening qualms as the day approaches and dares not speak her mind because so many preparations have been made on her behalf. The happiness and convenience of so many good people will be put at risk. These are fleeting moments.